Hi, I'm Michael Van Cleek. I'm tapped into the vibe and the rhythm of the river of the city of Portland. And you are too, because you're listening to KBOO Portland.
At KBOO, we accept many kinds of vehicle donations. We accept fuzzy vans, broken cars, zippy scooters, seaworthy boats, well-worn farm equipment, family-sized SUVs, old jet skis, and more. If your vehicle has a clean title, we can take it as a donation. If your vehicle isn't working, we can work with that too. Call our car donation experts at the Center for Car Donations to find out more info, ask questions, and support KBOO. Call 877-KBOO-123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our website, kboo.fm/vehicle.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root this mountain down. Wish I was a mole in the ground.
Malcolm X moment. Martin Luther King with a dream and war boning. Wounded knee plus Alcatraz, doggone it. This is for the rock with prayers we stand on it.
Oh yeah, we playing on it. The earth, we camp on it. In a sweat lodge, singing our songs with grandfathers. Heat rocks all in the spot. We splash on them with a beatbox from my boy. Be jam on it. Said a prayer for the black snake killers. Train on the front lines, they are the realest. Stand for your people, stand for your family. Stand with Standing Rock, stand for humanity.
It takes a group of people who actually care about, you know, Mother Earth and life and water being sacred and the land being sacred to say we stand up.
Tuts Maywee, good morning. You know, that was Eric Bibb singing I Wish I Was a Mole in the Ground, followed by the Stand Up for Standing Rock resistance anthem and a little bit of John Trudell in the mix. This is Desiree Helligers, and I'll be your host this morning for this special Indigenous Peoples Day program of the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial point of view. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the greatest issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. On today's Indigenous Peoples Day show, we feature all Indigenous musical artists, and we bring you a lineup of interviews conducted by students in the Documentary Arts Initiative, a joint project of WSU Vancouver's Native American program and the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice. First up on today's show, Missing and Murdered Indigenous People, MMIPs, Man Camps and Fossil Fuels. Ozia Wilson and Julian speak with MMIP advocates Michael Johnson and Nimipu Mol Julian Ankney about WSU Vancouver's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Initiative and about organizing to address the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous people and the role of the fossil fuel industry in fueling ongoing colonial violence against Indigenous people. Michael Johnson is a member of the Multnomah Budget Advisory Council and the Northwest Native Chamber Tribal Engagement Business Advisor. Julian Ankney is director of Native American programs at Washington State University, Vancouver. Julian's brother, Michael Murphy, has been missing since 2018. And then, Indigenous Pathways to Recovery. Courtney and Alex speak with Dominique Arthur, mentor with Painted Horse Recovery Center, and a drummer with PDX Wapatiksha Drum, about recovery and healing from colonial violence by reconnecting with Indigenous culture. And then finally, cultivating indigenous plant knowledge and first foods. Bethany Fisher and Isella speak with Julian Ankeny and Lakota Cheyenne organizer Robin White about revitalizing indigenous plant knowledge and cultivating first foods on WSU Vancouver's 350-acre campus with an indigenous traditional ecological cultural knowledge garden. They speak about iTech as an alternative to carbon-intensive global agribusiness. Robin White is enrolled Oglala at Pine Ridge, a member of the WSU Vancouver Native American Community Advisory Board, or NACAB, and a longtime member and organizer with WSU Vancouver's Collective for Social and Environmental Justice, or CSEJ. A co-creator of CSEJ's Thin Green Line is People's History Project, a digital archive of Pacific Northwest climate justice organizing. He is a longtime labor organizer and a former president of International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, Local 10. White is also a sculptor and a painter whose paintings have been exhibited internationally. First up, missing and murdered Indigenous people, man camps, and fossil fuels.
Hi, I'm Julian. So I think a good question to kind of get started and get into it is how you both got involved in the Missing Murdered Indigenous Peoples Initiative.
My name is Michael Johnson. I am an enrolled member of the Nez Perce tribe, and I have Yakima and Umatilla descendancy. I'm a direct descendant of Old Chief Joseph. I got involved in advocacy because, you know, I didn't have the privilege of looking away. We grow up hearing names, seeing faces, and watching family search for answers that rarely came. And these weren't distant stories. They were community members, relatives, and people whose absence continues to shape our lives. And I realized early on in my advocacy that people go missing twice, once in body and then and again, you know, in the silence that follows. And that silence is where I'm committed to like interrupting. And when I was at WSU, I actually did a fellowship with the Center for Native American Youth, and we focused on like raising awareness around MMIW, doing campus events, awareness walks, community conversations that really held space for visibility and healing and action. And that door has since opened up for me in my professional world to do advocacy on a state and federal level and work with other Native women advocates. And I think that just helped really affirm that it's our responsibility to our relatives, to our communities, and the next generations who deserve to grow old, to grow up and be safe and seen.
Definitely, yeah. Julian?
Thank you. Julian Ankeny. My name is Julian Ankeny. I am also Nimipu. I'm actually what's considered a direct descendant. So that means I am not enrolled, but one of my parents is. That's where I kind of fit in. And like Michael said, MMIP, MMIW, some people say MMIR for missing and murdered Indigenous relatives. It really touches me because my brother went missing in 2018. And I'm also here speaking for my uncle who went missing and was murdered actually by law enforcement in Spokane, Washington. One of my cousins also, Keith Hendrickson, he was murdered at the University of Idaho in the 90s. And I also have an auntie, Cleo, it's been like 23 years ago. Her daughter also was murdered, actually in Vancouver. And she has still received no justice. My brother, Michael Murphy, went missing, like I said, in 2018 from a place we call Seminicum, which is Nimipu Timpt, a word for confluence, where the two rivers meet, Snake into Clearwater. We were basically not believed by law enforcement because my brother had recently been released from prison. And then 2 weeks later, he vanished. It was really, really traumatic. When it happened, it was my first year of grad school too. And ever since then, I have been learning from people like Roxanne White. She has a mission for missing and murdered Indigenous people and families, where it's a survivor-led collective dedicated to bringing healing and justice to Indigenous communities because we're all affected by this. And they're basically committed to healing through cultural unity and ceremony and empowering Indigenous survivors to speak out and to speak up. Survivors of sex, and labor trafficking through culturally grounded healing opportunities, different leadership development, and community building to create a platform for those with lived experiences, call these people in to design those solutions, and really supporting MMIP family members, right, with their unique, because each family is also different, right? The unique and long-term needs to try to facilitate a path to awareness and justice. But also, right, we can't just have awareness and justice. We also have to have healing for the family members. So, and I think in a lot of respects, that's really the hardest part.
Definitely. Well, thank you guys so much for sharing that. Like, as Michael was saying, you know, sometimes we don't have the privilege to look away, and our advocacy often starts from a very young age. And has, you know, your resistance and advocacy changed since being involved in MMIP? And like, how do you go about in a respectful way, but a way that allows those, you know, who don't know about MMIP or those who didn't know about the issue?
No, thank you so much for that question. I think it really reshaped my worldview on Indigenous resistance in every way, emotional, spiritual, personal. Like, you know, I've come to see that our resistance, it isn't just a single moment of protest, right? It's our generational effort to really survive, to protect, and to rebuild what has been taken. And through this work, I've seen and witnessed resistance in so many forms, from families organizing, like Julian said, you know, organizing search efforts when the systems fail them, communities demanding policy change, or just even loved ones holding space for grief and silence, and, you know, ceremony, the incorporation of ceremony into these acts of resistance. I think that, you know, it's really shown me that it's not just about fighting back, but just also refusing to be invisible, saying their names, speaking up again for those voices that have been taken, and ensuring that their stories are carried forward. It's beautiful. It's also strategic, though, I think, for me in my work, in my advocacy work. At its core, it's really trying to navigate systems and to understand that very existence is just an act of defiance. And so going about it in a cultural way always is of the utmost importance to me. Doing it in, you know, a way our communities know our solutions, right? Our communities have our answers. We have the self-determination to do so. And it's just really about strengthening our own Indigenous systems. And I think that's kind of the root of my work.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you so much too, Michael. I just have to say that this is a problem that cuts across ages and genders. MMIP and families, again, is an inclusive initiative to bring awareness to the fact that while most of the attention and research is on the violence against Indigenous women and girls, our men and boys and Two-Spirit relatives are vulnerable as well. Not only are Indian women and girls going missing and murdered at a disproportionate rate, but so are our men and boys. So really no one, you know, Two-Spirit relatives, really no one is exempt from this. Men and boys are also getting, you know, molested and raped along with women and girls to make sure they are also placed in the context, right, of gendered and settler colonial violence as a whole. I think that's really important to know and understand. I started working with Roxanne White. She's out of Seattle area, and I started going to marches and just learning from her. And, you know, I went to her trainings, which again are provided by innovative survivor-led training for agencies and organizations that actually work with human trafficking survivors to prevent re-exploitation of survivors through harmful organizational practices as well, right? The universities and different, again, organizations are super extractive with, you know, they want to hear our traumatic tale of suffering, but then they never want to learn about how we're actually coming together as a community to heal too, right? So really uplifting and supporting Two-Spirit, trans, non-binary, and youth who have experienced trafficking as well. And then providing education on addressing familial trafficking in Indian country. We're trying to still build capacity for survivors to design, facilitate, and promote their own trainings that are steeped in the lived experiences, and to become knowledgeable in our own sacredness, right? But also how to identify and avoid those risky situations, not only for organizations, but like for healthcare practitioners, you know, law enforcement agencies. I feel like super important to know that every person that we search for or march for, grieve for, is another person that law enforcement has disregarded, devalued, dehumanized, and those cases were never brought to light.
You're listening to a special Indigenous Peoples Day edition of the Omo Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, and now back to Ozziah and Julian speaking with Julian Ankeny and Michael Johnson about murdered and missing Indigenous people.
We have a belief in Nez Perce, like human beings. All people are sacred people. All people are sacred beings. We just are still trying to bring attention to every border town and city that has abused, abducted, and trafficked Indigenous people that have been grossly ignored, and that these stories become the stories that the news media essentially refuses to tell, the cases that legal systems do not prosecute. Facts are that man camps, right, and oil and land acknowledgments are all interconnected to MMIP. The epidemic of missing Native people has been an almost invisible crisis, you know, forever. And just in recent years, has it actually been brought to the attention of the broader public?
No, definitely. Thank you again so much for sharing. Yeah, I think, like you were saying, education is very important. MMIP doesn't just include, you know, women, like you were saying, include men and boys and two-spirited people. It also includes, like, our protectors, you know, the protectors of the environment, and how detrimental it can be when those protectors go missing or murdered, and how it not only affects, you know, our communities, but the environment around us as well. And maybe Ozziah here can help transition. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of protectors going missing and how it impacts the fossil fuel transition?
Yeah, and I really want to thank Julian for that last part about the colonial violence and the man camps, because it really flows into our next question really well. In your advocacy around missing and murdered Indigenous people, have you found interconnections between the colonial violence that causes that and the violence of the violent exploitation of the land of the fossil fuel industry?
The same systems that treat Indigenous land as expendable, they treat Indigenous lives as expendable. And so I think that for me and my lived experience, I think that there is a direct, undeniable connection. You know, we talk about things like pipelines cutting through territories, or where camps, they cluster near communities. It's all extractive. It's violence, right, against all of the folks who we mentioned, our relatives, the women, the girls, the Two-Spirit folks, the men. And I think it's not coincidental, it's structural. I think, again, rooted in colonial entitlement in systems designed to profit off of our land without, you know, with ignoring human cost. And another thing to keep in mind is that there are a lot of loopholes in jurisdiction, inadequate law enforcement, and, you know, systems that really neglect and create conditions where our families are most at risk. And I think that, you know, the exploitation of land, the exploitation of bodies, that's intertwined, two sides of the same colonial violence. So I think that connection is so important to call on, and it really changes how we fight. Like, our advocacy cannot just be limited on one front. I think that protecting our people, it's inseparable from protecting our rivers, our forests, our sacred sites, right? And justice is, in a way, environmental justice for MMIW. Again, just resistance. It is ongoing violence against our communities. And I think that our advocacy is really revolutionary, because it asserts that our lives, our bodies, our spirits, our lands, they're not disposable.
Yeah, absolutely. Our relatives, right, and friends are going missing at a rate that is 10 times more than the national average. We need as much advocacy that is grassroots, community-based. There was also a study done by the Urban Indian Health Institute that found there's well over 7,000 cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, just women and girls reported since 2016, not including everyone else or even the undocumented cases. 96% of all violence Indigenous people are facing are from non-natives. And you can also check that out in the Department of Justice database as well. But again, those are only the cases that have been reported or have been actually reviewed and logged by law enforcement. There's so much more that hasn't been. And I would really like to acknowledge that Indigenous people stand in solidarity with our ancestors, that our story is a story of continued genocide throughout history. We were and continue to try to be, right, the stewards of the land that we live on, and believe that we are actually a part of the land. We are connected environmentally to the land. The bones of our ancestors fed so many different and continue to feed, right, as part of that cycle of life. We are connected, and we need to remember that those things cannot be, kind of as Michael was saying, those things cannot be disconnected.
Thank you both. And I really appreciate what Michael was saying, especially about the way with which Indigenous resistance is based in an alternative system and how that alternative system is how we resist this colonial power. And I would just like to ask more about how Work Like Land Back, Work Like the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Initiative, Work Like This, how people can support that and how people can help support Indigenous resistance, especially as things are picking up in this imperial core.
One of my favorite quotes from an elder is, "I am the land is me." It so deeply speaks to, I think, again, just to echo what Julian said in regards to how we view it, we're not disconnected. It's very much so a part of us in every way and in the way we interpret and navigate the world. And, you know, I think when we resist, we're not just, you know, pushing back against one issue, we're naming an entire structure, right? And I think that it's not just about missing people and relatives, it's about legal gaps, ignored data, you know, lack of political will, all of these systems at place. And I think that, you know, again, with environmental destruction, it's not just pollution, it's stolen land, it's broken treaties, and again, profit prioritized over people and lives. And so Indigenous resistance, it makes it clear, you know, these issues, they don't exist in isolation and they stem from the same system. So I think that's the connection there. But I think for us, it really is in our resistance, it's a demand for accountability. It's a demand to be seen, to be heard. And
thank you so much, Michael.
Yeah, thank you so much to both of you. I really appreciate everything you all have said. It really demonstrates to me we'll need to be working in an interconnected fashion, because that's how the systems we are working against and we're working to replace how they operate.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I just also want to say thank you again to Julian and Michael.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Desiree Helgers, and I'm your host for this morning's special Indigenous Peoples Day show on the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Hallucination singing Mother, Mother. And before that, you were listening to Ozziah Wilson and Julian speak with MMIP advocates Michael Johnson and Nimipu Mole Julian Ankeny about organizing to address the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Next up, Indigenous Pathways to Recovery. Courtney and Alex speak with Dominique Arthur.
Good afternoon, I'm Courtney.
I'm Alex.
My name is Dominique. I'm a Prime Plus mentor at Painted Horse Recovery.
and I work with Indigenous people who are out on the streets that are still in active addiction. And I myself am in recovery from addiction as well, coming up on 18 months.
What have you learned about yourself and your people in your time being a part of PDX Drum?
So I sing, whether it be on the big drum. We have two drums that we carry at my work. And I also sing with hand drums at meetings. And then I also sing without a drum on the Washut line, on the Willesset line. That's at, like, a longhouse way of culture and tradition of religion. I'm always asked to come sing wherever any event happens, any funerals happen, any recovery happens. We're always invited to open up a song.
How does your longhouse ways aid in recovery efforts and healing?
So I grew up in a longhouse with my grandmother, and it's been my religion since I was born, basically. And the songs are very, very old. You know, they've been passed down for many generations. And I have a loud voice when I sing, because that's how my grandma raised me, is, you know, sing loud and proud. So being Nez Perce, that's my tribe. I'm enrolled Nez Perce. My kids are all enrolled Nez Perce. My granddaughters will be. So she's very, at 1 year old, she's very connected to the longhouse ways. We did her first huckleberry pick, and we honored her in that way of the longhouse. You know, we sang seven songs. And then just growing up in that culture and that tradition and having that voice to sing with the drumline, because it's all a men drumline, and the women are on the side. We don't use drums, but we're able to, like, back up sing for them and hit the high notes, you know, during the songs of our culture. And just growing up and knowing these songs from a baby up until now, you know, I'm 37, and my little granddaughter's involved with our culture, and she's very involved with our traditions and comes to services with me. We have services every Sunday, and that's my way of giving back to my grandma. You know, my grandma had crossed over to the other side, and so just raising my kids and relearning songs, because that's a big part of who we are as Nez Perce people.
Just kind of touching on that bit of, like, culture, you've been quoted in saying that, you know, the drum is the heartbeat of our people. It calls us together, it tells us our stories, and reminds us of our strength and community. I guess, like, in this historic moment, this moment that we're living in history, that's definitely a little bit uncertain. Like, what stories do you think are important to tell through your music?
To be honest, there's so many different songs that are so old, you know, and, like, for us to be able in this year, 2025, to still be able to sing all them old songs, to carry that on for our ancestors, the ones that have gone before us, like my grandmother. My grandmother was raised by her uncle, and he was a bell ringer. A bell ringer means he was the leader of the whole drum line. And so he rings the bell. And during longhouse services, there's dancers that go out and dance in a circle. And when you hit the drum, like when the drum beat hits, that's like when you're supposed to be stepping. Like, they jump the whole time, but every time the drum beats, that's when your feet hit the floor. To stay in tune with that all the way around, and then they stop, and then once the bell rings again, then they go one more time around, and then they go back to where they started at. Mm. And that way, that's just been like that for many, many years, you know. And like I said, I've been raised in the longhouse. Till this day, I still dance on the wash, on the floor. When they call for dancers, they'll say the floor is open, and that means women on one side, men on the other, kind of facing each other. And then when we jump in sync and go all the way around with the drum beat. And a lot of times during funerals, they do that because it helps the person who passed on get to the other side. And on the other side is another line of drummers and dancers that welcome them to heaven, basically.
Thank you for sharing. What do rest, joy, humor, and play look like in your practice? And why do they matter for healing?
So me, I'm dedicated to the way of my religion. We have practice on Fridays at Painted Horse, where I work at. And then we also have Sunday services either at Painted Horse or at the Alano Club, because at the Alano Club they have Will Bridie. That's a meeting, like a sober meeting for Native Americans, and they'll do Sunday service before the meeting starts, and then it'll go into the Wilbriety meeting right after. And so for me, like I said, you know, I sing. That's a big, huge part of my recovery today. And just being able to share songs, because majority of the songs that we sing, is it comes from Nez Perce, it comes from Warm Springs, it comes from Umatilla, just any of the tribes that fish on the Columbia River. You know, we're all Columbia River Indians, Native Americans, and all these songs they're pretty similar. And we share these songs amongst each other that are here in Portland, because we're all from different tribes, and anyone that wants to be included comes to these, and we all show up for each other no matter what, and just keep that religion going here in the city, because we can't make it home for Sunday service.
I definitely like touching on that, you know, talking about spiritual like practices and stuff like that. Kind of want to talk a little bit about the history of banning and like criminalization when it comes to like indigenous spiritual and healing practices. They definitely tend to like disrupt intergenerational healing lineages. What forms of repair as a result of dealing with those bans that have only been lifted recently? Like, what forms of repair are most needed now?
So for myself, being in active addiction or alcoholism, that strays you away from where you come from. You know, that strays you away from the songs. That strays you away from your religion. And I was a big part of that, you know. I was in active addiction for a very long time. And so to have these places that are willing to open up a meeting or these practices that they have on Fridays, it really brings back culture. Like, there's times where people will hear us sing and they'll come in and check it out and then like get emotional, you know, because that's part of something that they're missing in their life, you know, like from being stuck addiction and not hearing these songs for a long time. And that's kind of like a big part of why I love doing it. You know, I'm able to sing songs today when before in my addiction I wasn't able to. And I just feel like it's just important to learn songs, you know, whether they're yours or not, because it's in our culture to do that. It's kind of generations either missed out on or, you know, been forgotten. So like, there's a point in time where the government had tried to take that from us, but we fought through it. We ran to the hills, we ran to the mountains, and we still continued these teachings. That's why they're still here today.
Thank you for sharing. What do you want audience members to take away from your collective performances, if you just had to let them know something?
My message to them would be just to feel the songs. You know, like I said, it brings up a lot of emotion, whether you know the religion or you don't. And especially if there's a bell involved, that's like, it touches something inside, you know. And that's something that I love hearing anytime, like the drums, because there's a point at the beginning is when they're like letting the spirits know we're here, you know, we're still here. And it's like a drum beat that they do before they sing, and then the bell ringing. It's like a message to let them know that we're still here.
That's great. I guess the last question that we have for you today is kind of just in summation. We're currently living in a really uncertain and reactionary time, especially this year, and it's a lot to deal with. In your perspective, how can an understanding of the history of Indigenous peoples and their cultural practices help us navigate our way through this really tumultuous time that we're living in?
Through songs. I'm not even gonna lie, just a few weeks ago we sang it right outside the ICE building. You know, we sang 7 songs outside of the ICE building and didn't get maced, didn't get pushed away. We were close, we were right outside their door. And I believe there's some videos going around of us doing that. And it wasn't just me, it was our whole drumline and 3 women and the rest men. And we stood outside, literally outside their door, and sang 7 songs. And like, the government's not going to take that from us.
Thank you for all of your insights. Yeah, we've both definitely learned a lot.
Yeah. Yes. Thanks for your time and sharing your experiences.
Remember me.
Remember me.
When the sun comes up in the morning sky, there I will be.
There I will be.
Soaring with the eagle so high, feeling free.
Remember me.
That was Fawn Wood singing Remember Me, and before that you were listening to Courtney and Alex speaking with Dominique Arthur, a mentor with Painted Horse Recovery Center, about recovery and healing from colonial violence by reconnecting with Indigenous culture. Up next, cultivating Indigenous plant knowledge and first foods.
My name is Bethany Fisher.
And my name is Isela.
And we are here welcoming Julian Ankeny and Robin White as we discuss the new Indigenous Traditional Ecological and Cultural Knowledge Garden, otherwise known as the iTech Garden, here at WSU Vancouver. So I just want to ask, what was the desire or inspiration behind starting the iTech Garden, and what did it take to turn that desire into a reality?
This is Robin White. Everything revolves around water. You know, water is life. It's the most important medicine. It's the first medicine in our culture, and really is in everybody's. They sometimes just don't realize that, you know, we're stardust bags that carry around a bunch of water and that we borrow. And when we think about what we do, you know, we're taking water and we're turning it into nutrients for ourselves. And in the traditions that we have, we honor that water and we honor the things that come from that water. So certainly our foods and our plants and the things around us that we are thankful for and we try and nurture and be responsible for. And we don't find that being done in society in general. And through the university and through Collective for Social and Environmental Justice, particularly early on, Desiree and I, and then we were so lucky to get Julian on board to help us get this launched and get going. In every aspect of society, everything, you know, is depends on that water and on that food. We realize that if you have control of your food system within your community, then you are powerful and you have control of your life. You know, if you have the financial, the banking, if you have the labor part, if you have the water, you know, thinking in watersheds versus these borders and things that are kind of made up as people go along and fits their needs rather than the needs of reality. If you're, you know, planning for future building and society within the county or the state, you really need to consider your food systems. And we have found that, you know, during COVID and during the big storms, and these type of things are going to happen more and more because of climate collapse, that our food systems went down. They did not work. Transportation didn't work. Water systems didn't work. Social systems broke down. Governmental systems broke down. So if we have control of that within our communities, all our money, the economy stays within the community, you know, it's just a safer, better way to live. So we really were trying to make sure that started at the university with iTech and gardens to not only feed the students and the faculty, and I think it's a criminal that we have faculty sleeping in their cars and being, you know, not having enough food, but we needed to change it at that level. And so I think starting the gardens there was very important. We, you know, the administration, all they wanted was, oh, well, we'll put some Indian names on some plants out in the fields, and then, you know, we're good, then we're covered, because we, you know, the Indians are noted and the food is noted. Well, yeah, that's great, but no, that's not what we were talking about. We were talking about changing the social values and the economic values within our community. And so it was a big push, but we finally kind of got it over, you know, and we still have to keep this going. So, you know, you need the community involved. You need the students involved, you need the faculty, the administration, and the community in general. And I think we've started doing that. And with your guys' help at the student level, I think it's working, and we need to continue to make that work. And, you know, it was just a labor of love and respect that started it.
Julian, is there anything you want to add to that?
When did we first start talking about this, the iTech Garden? It was definitely before my time. I actually came into the position, you know, asking our NACAB board, Native American Community Advisory Board here at WCU Vancouver, like, hey, y'all, what do we need? And of course, Robin and a few other people, they chimed in, like, one of the things that we've been talking about for a long, long time. I think Desiree had said that it was about 20 years of trying to get a campus garden, and it's always been a no until recently. I just think that it really is the legacy, right, of Indigenous knowledge holders to share our traditional knowledge, not only for us or just for our family, but for everyone. And it's really our belief that we want to benefit 7 generations of people into the future. And one of the things that is so interesting about this is our Indigenous ancestors have already created and are also, of course, willing to teach us those pathways into the future that have always centered food sovereignty, sustainability, and community-centered regenerative food economies, and also infrastructures, right? That the garden has really begun to center not only food security for students, but Indigenous ecological knowledge. Environmental activists have already came, you know, and given talks. We have artists. We have, you know, students who are buying into and helping us with different infrastructure innovations, right? But really, it started from community support. I think from the beginning, or the inception of this, which again was way before my time, I may have been 12 years old when this started talking about, really has been an ongoing project. And again, just this last year, we were actually able to break ground finally.
What would you say makes the iTech Garden different or unique from other gardens? Like, what are the specific plants in there? What specific techniques are we doing?
Really, it's about, for me, it's about lifeways and landscapes. So again, Indigenous people and our allies are really... we're the ones that are holding the solutions to these expanding problems that now science is actually backing what we've been saying, right, since time immemorial. So those ancestral lifeways and landscapes are what spurred our ancestors, right, to optimize collective, but also reciprocal and regenerative food systems and economies. These are not new ideas. These systems in turn kind of cultivate community, self-reliance, determination, and resiliency. And we're really creating community around these different garden spaces. I think there was a study done, I want to say in 2022, it might have been 2021, where ASWSUV did a survey of nearly 300 students that voiced their support for the garden. So we started basically collecting like data from students, supporting the demand for this project and for fresh food and produce on campus is literally overwhelming. And we really wanted to, right, bring fresh food, not prepackaged food, to students in the garden. We wanted the garden to provide that outdoor space, not only for growing food, but also to teaching students how to grow food. So an outdoor classroom that we wanted to basically, and we already have been integrating that garden classroom integrated across the curriculum.
This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to a special Indigenous Peoples Day episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour.
The garden will be a really excellent and sustainable source of fresh produce, again, for food insecure students. It'll provide some students job opportunities, an event space for student organizers, such as yourself, right? And help build community and a sense of a really strong belonging on campus.
I'm kind of hoping to see some of the spiritual elements taught about this too, and bringing in those social aspects. And this is a learning garden. So, you know, things have changed since 500 years ago. And, you know, the climate itself has changed. The seasons have changed. The availability of water sources has changed. Pollution sources, all these things that, you know, we need to reconsider and, you know, redo the way that we do things and rethink the way that we do things. But certainly, you know, the Cheyenne used to have a saying that if you have your children closer than 4 years, that you're killing your oldest child. Well, that was a social aspect because the way that those societies were set up, your aunts and uncles and grandmas and grandpas all had specific things to do with those children and responsibilities as they grew up. And if you started having them too close together, that couldn't be done properly. But the other part was environmental. It was because you over used your food sources and your renewable resources. We are not an endless source of resources in this world. We're just not. And we're coming to that end of those resources. And how are we going to navigate that? And hopefully, as we get rid of the use of fossil fuels and a lot of the, you know, dependence on chemicals as we do things. And I think this type of garden and this type of education will help us do that. This really is a learning, an ongoing learning thing that everybody's going to learn from, including Indigenous people, because we can't learn until we do. We don't know until we do. We haven't been allowed to do the things that we used to do. So, you know, we're trying to elbow our way into our rights and our responsibilities. You know, if you're looking at the university and all the things that we're doing, most of the jobs you're seeing, especially in the sciences, when you're coming out of there, are tied to the tribal economy and to the Bolt decision, which basically stated that we have rights to clean water, to fish, that we own the fish, or at least 50% of them, and that we can go and collect food in the usual and accustomed places. And if not, then we get somewhere in lieu. In other words, in a place that we can do that. So this is part of that food system that we're talking about. And this is we've been doing some of that, but of course we usually get put in jail for doing those things. And now that Bolt decision says that the United States and all the subservient governments within have to make sure that we have clean water and that we have the availability of those foods, we need to use that leverage, not only as Indians, but as good human beings, to do the right thing and to repair the damages that we've done and that we're doing to Mother Earth and to the water.
We had to garner not only support across the system, but community support as well. So some of the things that I've already begun to do is a traditional foods and medicine workshop. We had a little mini one where I had a few students make little medicine bags with medicines from campus, right? And that was really about skill sharing. How we're taking these traditional foods and these traditional medicines that we've, again, been using since time immemorial and sharing some of those skills. Already been able to donate food to a couple different food banks, right? Including our own food pantry on campus. We're going to have seed harvesting, saving, preserving, and sharing those seeds with elders and students, right? And really reestablishing some of those cooperative pathways to sovereign food systems. within various communities, not just Native communities. When we want all of our communities to be a part of this, we're already starting to have traditional cultural arts workshops with some of these harvested materials. Like I'm doing a workshop where we're going to be making some tule mats, but we also have plans to harvest materials like cedar bark, sage, sweetgrass, kinnikinick. We already have planted elderberry, which of course is one of our medicines. We have kinnikinick, we have salal, and we have salmonberry planted already, along with some quinault strawberry as well. So it's not only sharing knowledge, it's the restoration of also some culturally relevant sites on campus. I had many talks with one of our NACAB members, Mike Ayal, and I learned a lot about the land in connection to Cowlitz people. The Cowlitz people called the area that WSU Vancouver sits on, they called it Simsit. And why is it called Salmon Creek? Well, because Waukeepa, back in the day, right, there used to be salmon in that creek. So it's not that we're just taking from the land. We're also going to be restoring some habitat and re-indigenizing certain parts of campus as well, not just in the iTech Garden. We're getting a lot of community support, student support, and administrative support now as well.
Landscape changes as administrations come in at a federal, state, or county, or city level, or at the university level. Students come and go. Administration comes and goes. So how do you set that up? How do you make sure that the students are interested in educating the incoming students on the importance of what you're doing?
We're envisioning a living cedar fence. So cedar for us, again, as Indigenous people, is one of our like sacred plant relatives. And we're going to be growing food up, so vertically on the fence as well. So we're really trying to utilize every aspect. Dear relatives, were there before WSU was WSU and before WSU was a dairy farm.
Before the dairy farm, it was a salmon for Native people. It was a salmon processing place.
Wow, yeah, so... Again, I want to circle back to restoring those culturally significant sites, not only on campus, but on Salmon Creek. So
I want to thank you both so much for joining us today and taking the time to talk to us. I think I speak for everyone when I say that the students and faculty here can't wait to see what the future brings for the iTech Garden.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Planet but grew up in the conditions where hot environments, fed us but no nutrition now. Check it better with what I wrote down. Feeding the soil, hoping to grow now. From the youth, we ain't had a truth. Disconnected from the roots, we ain't had a proof. It consumed every part of the food we grew now. Just because they wanna profit off you. And every hood it doesn't get the bread of feeding the addiction. The feed us all with the cure. Rather be selling the prescription division. Wishing the mission division isn't the ripple. We gotta be coming together by building echo resiliency. Earth holding the lessons of ancestors. While these booms go to-to-sha. While my customers at the bottom saying suguna.
Drums of war in this field.
This is KBOO Portland. You've been listening to a special Indigenous Peoples Day version of the Omo Variety Hour. All of the interviews on today's show were conducted by students with the WSU Vancouver Documentary Arts Initiative, a joint project of Native American Program and the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice. I just want to take a quick second, too, to plug the upcoming Northwest Teaching for Social Justice Conference. Meet with and learn from educators who are producing cutting-edge social justice curriculum. More information about the conference can be found at nwtsj.org. That's nwtsj.org. Thanks to interviewers Osiah Wilson, Julian, Courtney Allen.
to Community Radio KBOO Portland.